A few weeks ago, I gave a message about the prophet Elijah. He's arguably the most prominent prophet in Scripture, referred to in Malachi, mentioned in Paul and James and their epistles, and 28 times in the Gospels. Elijah appeared along with Moses at the Transfiguration. Many thought Jesus himself was Elijah, returning to fulfill the prophecy of Malachi. Even today, the Jews set aside a cup of wine for Elijah at their Passover Seder, hoping, at least symbolically, for his return. Yet, as I pointed out, that while Elijah gets all of this attention, while he was zealous in fulfilling God's witness to Ahab and the people of Israel, he was very much a loner, usually considered to be an introvert. He performed several spectacular miracles, however. Depending upon how you count them, between 7 and 11 miracles are recorded. And most of these miracles centered on judgment, sometimes of a very fiery nature, including the confrontation with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel and the destruction of 2 units of 50 soldiers each sent by the king to take him. He pronounced a drought on the nation, the gory death of King Ahab and Jezebel for killing Naboth so they could take his vineyard. And he pronounced the judgment of God that King Ahaziah would die from his illness for not seeking God. Elijah also suffered from depression and seemingly couldn't wait to have a successor take over. So today, I thought I would take a look at Elijah's successor, and see how his ministry compared to that of Elijah, with a focus on his interactions with a very remarkable woman. We first hear of Elisha when God tells Elijah to anoint him to take Elijah's place. It appears Elijah immediately left the mountain of God, found Elisha, threw his mantle on him. We don't know a lot about Elisha's origins, but perhaps a little more than we know about Elijah. We know he was the son of Shaphat in a town called Abel Meholah, halfway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. Of Elijah, we only know that he was a Tishbite from the region somewhere in Gilead. We don't know anything much about him. Elisha appears to have been from a wealthy family. When found by Elijah, he is plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. And when called to be Elijah's servant, he slaughters one pair of oxen and holds a large goodbye feast for family and friends. Not a cheap thing to do. We also know Elisha was bald and Elijah was hairy, for those interested in physical appearance contrasts. We hear no more of Elisha until God decides to finally remove Elijah from his role and put Elisha in charge instead. And that account is in 2 Kings 2. And we'll read 2 Kings 2 beginning in verse 1. And it came to pass, when the Eternal was about to take Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Then Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Eternal lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Eternal will take your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." These sons of the prophets seem to be schools of young men that Elijah and Elisha set up. Elijah visits 3 of them before he is taken. He started in Gilgal, he went to Bethel, and now he returns to Jericho. In verse 4, Elijah says to him, "Elisha, stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to Jericho." But he said, as the Eternal lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho. Now the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho came to Elisha and said to him, do you know that the Eternal will take away your master from over you today? So he answered, yes, I know. Keep silent. Then Elijah said to him, stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to the Jordan. But he said, as the Eternal lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So the two of them went on, and 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Now Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. And so it was, when they had crossed over, that Elijah said to Elisha, ask, what may I do for you before I am taken away from you? Elisha said, please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. So he said, you have asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you, but if not, it shall not be so. Then it happened, as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire, separated the two of them, and Elijah went by a whirlwind into heaven. And Elisha saw it, and he cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. So he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and rent them into two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, where is the Eternal God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. Now when the sons of the prophets who were from Jericho saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. They knew now that Elisha was in charge. Since he had seen Elijah being taken from him, it was an indication that his desire for a double portion would be granted. How was that meant to be manifested? Well, while the number of miracles recorded for each prophet is open to dispute, it is generally recognized that Elisha performed twice as many miracles as Elijah did, anywhere from 14 to 22, depending on what you count as a miracle. I also think that the nature and motives behind those miracles may be an indication of a greater exercising of God's Spirit in his ministry. As I said earlier, the miracles and prophecies Elijah was asked to perform were heavy on judgment and even destruction. Only one person was the positive beneficiary of the miracles he was directed by God to perform. The widow of Zarephath was given the miracle of an endless supply of flour and oil and received her son back from the dead. But that was it. Elisha, by contrast, was much more of a healer of people and the nation. He was asked by God to perform many miracles involving compassion and care, as well as healing. Many of these involved the sons of the prophets. He sweetened the brackish water at Jericho for them. He caused a cruse of oil to flow until all the vessels that a widow of one of the sons of the prophets had been told to gather were full, so she could sell the oil, get out of debt, spare her sons from slavery, and continue to live comfortably. He purified a pot of poisoned soup from them during a famine when there was little else they could eat. He multiplied loaves to feed 100 men. And he made an axe head float that had slipped from the axe handle that one of the students was holding to build a larger dormitory. And there were others besides the sons of the prophets. He healed Naaman of leprosy. There were the miracles involving the woman of Shunem. And in a most remarkable, posthumous miracle, a man was resurrected when his body came in contact with the bones of Elisha. So Elisha performed a lot of miracles, as I said. Even his pronouncements of judgment and defeat were primarily on Israel's enemies, not on Israel. He was involved in the defeat of the Moabites while simultaneously supplying Israel's army with much needed water to drink. He prophesied the deliverance of Israel from the siege of Syria and its resulting famine overnight. And when Syria made plans to attack Israel, Elisha warned the king there and thereby helped him to avoid defeat from the Syrians. When Israel's king had sent soldiers to get Elijah, Elijah called fire down from heaven twice to destroy the would-be captors. When the king of Syria sent soldiers to capture Elisha for repeatedly warning the king of Israel about his invasion plans, instead of destroying the army, he asked God to blind them, then personally led them to the capital of Samaria and instructed the king to feed them and send them back home. As you can see, the contrast between the two and what they were asked to perform by God was quite remarkable. Elisha did not hide himself. He tended to live in cities and towns. We find him in Gilgal, Jericho, Bethel, Samaria, Dothan, Mount Carmel, and Shunem. Most of these places containing groups of the sons of the prophets. When a king needed to find him, he was available, even if the king was angry with him. As with Elijah, the kings of Elisha interacted with were the kings of Israel rather than Judah, and none of them were listed as being good kings in Scripture. Nevertheless, these kings tended to hold Elisha in great respect and honor. When Elisha brought the Syrian army into Samaria, the king asked, "My father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them?" and proceeded to obey Elisha's instructions to feed them and let them go. There was the king who visited Elisha on his deathbed. It says that he wept over his face and said, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen," referencing the very words that Elijah had spoken when Elisha had left them. Of course, there was one time that a king wanted to blame Elisha for a famine and sent a messenger to kill him. But even then, he seems to have realized that was only an emotional reaction, and he went running after the messenger to stop him, at which point Elisha told him the famine would end tomorrow. We know from Jesus' words that John the Baptist was a type of the Elijah. He did no miracles, but he did preach repentance and a judgment to come as he prepared the way for the Messiah. While John was a fulfillment of Elijah's prophecy, in that sense, Elisha was more a type of Christ, performing miracles for the benefit of others and mixing compassion in with his calls to reform. And perhaps no story illustrates the points I've been making better than that of the woman of Shunem. You'll find the story a couple of chapters later in the book of 2 Kings, Chapter 4. The 2 Kings chapter 4, we'll start in verse 8. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman. Other translations say she was a great woman or a wealthy woman. And she persuaded him to eat some food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, that he would turn in there to eat some food. She said to her husband, "Look, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please, let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let's put a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair and a lampstand. So it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. As with Elisha, this woman exhibited much compassion in dealing with others. I think if any woman in Scripture exemplifies what Solomon described in Proverbs 31, it is this woman. She was very respectful to her husband as the one in charge, but she initiated all of this hospitality, to which her husband, apparently a much older man, readily consented. Her husband trusted her. Hospitality is a quality that is emphasized frequently in the Scriptures. We read of Abraham entertaining the three visitors, perhaps recognizing them up front as heavenly emissaries, but perhaps not until the visit progressed. Later, when Abraham sent his servant to Nahor to find a wife for Isaac, the servant asked God to use a test of hospitality to identify her. Would she offer him water and also water for his camels? And that was the woman he wanted. I'm not going to read all the following verses that I'm going to refer to. Write them down and look them up later if you're inclined to take notes. Otherwise, I'll just read them off. Hospitality is one of the qualifications of an elder, as we read in 1 Timothy 3:2. And one of the expectations of a very special category of widow described by Paul in 1 Timothy 5. Paul admonishes all Christians to be given to hospitality in Romans 12:13. Jesus told his disciples that when he went out to preach, they should seek out someone given to hospitality from which to establish their base of operations, as we read in Matthew 10. And it was a role that Lydia carried out for Paul and his group when they came to Philippi in Acts 16:4-15. And in Hebrews 13:2, we find this admonishment. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. In verse 11 of 2 Kings 4, it happened one day that he came there and he turned into the upper room, lay down there, and he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite woman. When he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, say now to her, look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? The you here is singular feminine. Elisha was specifically addressing and wanting to reward her. Her husband had certainly agreed to her hospitality, but Elisha was fully aware of who provided it. And as an illustration of the esteem in which he was held, Elisha had no doubt he could make a request to either the king or the commander of the army, and it would be granted. The woman answered, I dwell among my own people. This woman was content. There was nothing she thought she needed. But Elisha talked it over with Gehazi. In verse 14, he said, what then is to be done for her? Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son, and her husband is old. So he said, call her. When he had called her, she stood in the doorway, and then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. This was not something she had even dreamed of asking for, but Elisha had discovered a way he could reward her hospitality. In verse 17, it says, the woman conceived, bore a son, when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. And the child grew, Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers, and said to his father, "My head, my head." We're not told how old the child was. He was still small enough to be carried by the servant and even his mother, yet old enough to independently visit his father, who was supervising the reaper operation on their land. Certainly must have been a preteen. We're also not told what was wrong with him. Had he fallen and hit his head? Some form of severe sunstroke? Perhaps a brain tumor? The details, even if known, were not important. But his father said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." And in verse 20, when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and went out. And she called her husband and said, "Please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and come back." So he said, "Why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath." It's possible that her husband was not as devoted to God as she was. If it had been the Sabbath, would he have expected to be involved? Or was his devotion something he just accepted of her? Nevertheless, he had full faith in her. If she had an errand to run 10 miles down the road, she obviously had her reasons. But not wanting to alarm him yet, she responded only by saying, "It is well." And in verse 24, she saddled a donkey, said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you." So she departed and went to the man of God on Mount Carmel. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant, "Look, the Shunammite woman. Please run now to meet her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?'" And she answered, "It is well." Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. I'm reminded of the many times that the disciples tried to push away people who desperately wanted to see Jesus. But the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." This woman refused to tell anybody what her mission was. But she had been promised a son by Elisha. God had granted this miracle. And as with Isaac, she expected that God could restore this miracle child to life again if necessary. Isaac was spared that when Abraham was stopped from going through with the sacrifice. But this woman sought out a miracle. So she said, "Did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me?'" Elisha was pretty perceptive. He said to Gehazi, "Get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand. Be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child." And the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." These are words that must have been pretty familiar to Elisha. He had said those exact words to Elijah 3 times when Elijah had told him to stay while he went on, as we read earlier. The persistence she showed with Elijah was being shown to him now. So he arose and followed her. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying, "The child has not awakened." When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. It's obvious the child was quite dead, had been gotten cold by now. Why he did this particular procedure, we're not told. It was not a simple matter of artificial resuscitation, as some have tried to claim. He did not keep it up until he started breathing on his own. And he undoubtedly continued to pray earnestly to God throughout this time. In verse 35, he returned, walked back and forth in the house, praying in earnest as he paced the floor. And again went up and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite woman." So he called her, and when she came into him, he said, "Pick up your son." So she went in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground, and she picked up her son and went out. We are told Elisha then returns to Gilgal, where he performs more miracles. We have the story of Naaman, and still more miraculous events, until we come to chapter 8. In chapter 8, verse 1, Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, "Arise and go, you and your household, and stay wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine, and furthermore, it will come upon the land for 7 years." So the woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and dwelt in the land of the Philistines 7 years. This woman had learned to trust Elisha. She was probably now a widow and the one in charge of her household. But leaving her land and everything behind to live among a foreign people before the famine had even started took a lot of faith. Famines are mentioned so many times in relation to Elisha's ministry. I'd like to think that they all may be part of the same 7-year famine and just not being related in sequence. But more likely, there was just a lot of famine going on, probably as a result of the king and the people not doing God's will. But God took care of this widow in warning her through Elisha and protecting her during that 7 years. And now God steps in for the remarkable conclusion that he is so good at bringing about. Because when she returns, her land has been taken over, probably by the king himself. It was a really prime location overlooking the Valley of Jezreel, and certainly such an abandoned property would not go untouched. Verse 3, it came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and for her land. Well, in verse 4, we find that the king was talking to Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me, please, all the great things Elisha has done." This is another demonstration of the esteem in which Elisha was held, although I'm sure the stories of these things would fascinate anyone, just as they do us today, friend or foe. But still, he was being asked to relate more stories. And one story in particular Gehazi enjoyed telling about, one that he himself had a big role in. In verse 5, it happened as he was telling the king how he, Elisha, had restored the dead to life, that there was the woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life." And when the king asked the woman, she told him. See, in other words, she described the event, confirming all that Gehazi had said. The timing here was just amazing. And if this was the woman God had so miraculously blessed, he'd better not deny her request, lest he be fighting against God himself. So continuing in verse 6, so the king appointed a certain officer for her, saying, restore all that was hers and all the proceeds of the field from the day that she left the land until now. God took care of this widow and even had the king restore whatever proceeds the land had produced during the famine. Might not have been much, but he made sure that she was restored. Elisha's ministry was very different from that of Elijah, partly because Elisha was a very different person. He was not the loner Elijah was. He made his presence known as he traveled regularly from town to town, and he demonstrated compassion with the many people he came in contact with. This is not to say Elisha was somehow better than Elijah. They had different roles. Christ said there was not a greater man than John the Baptist, and arguably there was no greater prophet than Elijah. But if Elisha is a type of Christ, there is much we can learn from the things he was asked to do. And if there is an Elijah to come, then perhaps Elisha reflects some of what the millennium will be like. Unlike those people we interacted with, we don't have the benefit of seeing those miracles. Jesus said, blessed are those that have not seen and yet believe. The stories of Elisha are remarkable to hear about, as the king observed, but they also contain examples we can learn from, even though we do not experience them directly. We may not be given the ability to perform the miracles Elisha did, but we too can show compassion to those we encounter. We may not always have axe heads float to bail us out of a difficult situation, but we learn that God provides for our needs, and there are many ways that God intervenes in our lives. And there is no better example for us to follow than the Shunammite woman, who demonstrated hospitality, generosity, and profound faith, and who relied on God to provide in wondrous ways.